I called Deborah. "Great news," I said. "I met a collector out here who's going to sell the Russell and send us the money." Deborah sounded guarded. "What's he like?" I hesitated, not sure an accurate description would be helpful. "Well, his name is Barney Goldberg. Did you get a receipt or contract?" "No. You do have insurance on the painting, don't you?" "No." "Are you crazy?" she unloaded into the phone. "This sounds like a scam. You go back to that house and get that painting." "It's too late," I said, suddenly exhausted. "I'm out of money. My plane is leaving in a few minutes." I hung up and flew back to Fort Worth, guts churning. The next day I began trying to call Goldberg to get a receipt at the very least, but each time I dialed, long unanswered rings sang through the line, mocking me across the miles. I called every day for 43 days and never reached him. As the 90-day clock wound down, Mr. Crowfoot began phoning me almost daily to remind me of where to send his check. Nerves ate 20 pounds off my bones. On the 44th and final day, I called Snookums again, this time from the bank, and he finally answered. "Where have you been, and why haven't you answered your phone?" I yelled. "Poopsie," he said in a mild reproach, "I've been in Hawaii." He pronounced it Hawaii. "Don't give me that poopsie crap. Where's my money?" "Check your account," he said calmly. "I wired it to you a couple of days ago." I put him on hold, called down to Jean in bookkeeping, who informed me that $40,000 was sitting in my account, having been wired there by a Mr. Barney Goldberg. Relieved beyond belief, I punched up Snookums again, thanked him, hung up, and broke into the creeping sweat that usually follows a narrowly avoided car crash. And yet, on a single painting, I just cleared a profit nearly equal to my annual salary at the bank. Within a few days, I was planning a new deal with Snookums. A few weeks later, I quit the bank. And a few months later, the money started rolling in. Chapter 12. As newlyweds, Deborah and I were just your basic Sunday-go-to-meetin' Methodists. We parked ourselves in the pews most Sundays, and definitely every Easter and Christmas, since in those days it was still the widely held opinion that only hell-bound heathens, and possibly lawyers, skipped church on Easter and Christmas. We kept up that pattern until 1973, when some friends from a Bible church invited us to their home for a 6-week discussion group about life. As it turned out, we had actually been labeled lost, non-believing, and unsaved, possibly because we had no fish stickers on our cars. Which reminds me of one friend who, though newly born again, retained the bad habit of flipping off other drivers while barreling down the road in her Suburban. Even with her newfound religion, she couldn't control her middle finger. But according to her husband, the Holy Ghost prompted her to scrape the fish off her bumper until her finger got saved. Unsuspecting, my wife and I joined the discussion group at the Williamsburg-style home of Dan and Pat McCoy. Dan was an ex-TCU football player who was 6'5" and 275 pounds, so when he invited us to his house, I was afraid not to say yes. That first Sunday night, we were surprised to find exactly 40 people, 20 couples, we found out later, divided equally into saved and saved nots. Pat had set out an attractive buffet, brownies, lemon bars, coffee, iced tea, but strangely, no one so much as grazed. I've since deduced that it's always a trap when you don't get to eat until after you hear the talk. We introduced ourselves around and listened for an hour while a fresh-scrubbed, close-cropped man named Kirby Coleman addressed the whole group on the burning questions of existence. Why are we here? What is our purpose? What happens when we die? Quite frankly, I thought Kirby looked too young to know any of the answers. After the group talk, he tracked us down at the buffet table. "Are you a Christian?" he asked Deborah. He may as well have asked her if she was a human being. "I was born a Christian," she replied, insulted beyond belief. "But are you saved?" he pressed. "Are you certain you're going to heaven?" Deborah put one hand on her hip and pointed the other one in Kirby's face. "Well," she said, "my daddy paved the parking lot at the Snyder Methodist Church, and that's good enough for me." Deborah Hall had just about enough of Mr. Kirby Coleman, so much so that we went back to tussle with him again the next week, and the next. Each Sunday evening, the discussion funnel narrowed further from general philosophizing about life to pointed evangelization. After 5 weeks, I had it figured out. If you hadn't accepted Jesus by the sixth Sunday, you were probably going to hell on Monday. So on the last night after we went home, I told Deborah I was going to pray the sinner's prayer Kirby had told us about. "I don't see the point," she said. "How could I have lived this long, been in church all my life, and still have to do that? It doesn't make any sense. Besides, it just seems too easy." So I prayed without her, asking God to forgive my sins in the name of his son, Jesus. Deborah, however, cross-examined the gospel like a prosecutor on a federal case, and it was eventually the lawyerly arguments in books by C.S. Lewis and Josh McDowell that convinced her Christianity could stand up to her intellectual rigor. Finally, she prayed the prayer too. That's how the Jesus wave that swept across college campuses in the 1960s caught us in the suburbs before it slipped out to sea. I guess we were pretty good at the whole Christian thing, or maybe we were bad at it, because we managed to alienate many of our old college friends. With our new spiritual eyes, we could see they didn't have fish stickers either, and we set about saving them from eternal damnation with all the subtlety of rookie linebackers. Looking back now, I mourn the mutual wounds inflicted in verbal battles with the unsaved. In fact, I've chosen to delete that particular term from my vocabulary, as I have learned that even with my $500 European designer bifocals, I cannot see into a person's heart to know his spiritual condition. All I can do is tell the jagged tale of my own spiritual journey and declare that my life has been the better for having followed Christ.
Chapter 13. On the land where Herschel Lee lived, there was 3 or 4 plantations, all run up next to each other, like patches on a quilt. That meant there was 3 or 4 men that worked the black folks, different ones on different parts of the cotton. But to us, they was all the man. When I was 18 or 19, one of them gave me my own place a ways down the road from Herschel Lee. I was feeling pretty good about it. A man and all that. Even though my house was really just a two-room shack, I didn't know no better. I thought I was moving up. My place was built right up near a sycamore tree, so it had some shade in the summertime. I had a bed, a table, two chairs, and a pot-bellied stove all to myself. Had my own outhouse, too. I thought I was living high on the hog. Used to be the thinking in Red River Parish that there wasn't nothing lower than a sharecropper. There was, though, and I was it. There was a crack I fell through, and others with me. Except I didn't know it at the time. See, there was croppers, and there was children of croppers. Most of them was croppers, too. But some of them, especially them that never learned how to read or figure, stayed on the land, working for nothing but a place to live and food to eat, just like slaves. Oh, there was an understanding that we still owed the man. I knew he still kept books at his store and penciled down everything I took out the door on credit. There just wasn't no way to pay it off, 'cause the man didn't weigh the cotton no more. I knew I owed him, and he knew I owed him. And that's the way it stayed. Here was the damnable thing about it. Before Abe Lincoln freed the slaves, white folks wanted their plantations to run self-sufficient, so they made sure their slaves was trained up to do plenty of jobs. That's how come there was blacksmiths and carpenters, shoemakers, barbers, and slaves that could weave and sew and build wagons and paint signs and such. By the time I come along, though, that wasn't true no more. All them kind of jobs was white jobs in the South, and the only kind of jobs for colored folks was working the land. But after a while, even that started to dry up. Around the time I was 3 or 4, white planters started buying up tractors, which meant they didn't need so many colored hands to make their crops no more. That's when they started forcing them off their land. Whole families with little children, daddies and mamas that didn't know no other life, didn't know nothing about how to make a crop for somebody else. Forced off, sometimes at the point of a shotgun. No money, no place to live, no job, no way to get one. Like I said before, there was about 20 colored families, about 100 souls, on the man's plantation, each of them working a plot of land for him. But slowly, over the years, the man made them leave till there was maybe only about 3 or 4 families left. All I knowed was my life. For nearly 30 years, I sweated in the Louisiana sun, fighting off snakes, working the earth till harvest, and picking that cotton one bowl at a time till my hands was raw, growing my own food, chopping wood all winter long to keep from freezing to death, starting all over in the spring. That ain't no bad life if your labor is for your own land, but it wasn't. And I don't guess that kind of life would be bad if it was somebody else's land and you was getting paid. But I wasn't. Most folks these days ain't got no idea what it's like to be that poor. Me and the other folks on the plantation was down so low, we didn't own nothing except the tin can that hung on our britches so we could get us a drink. We didn't even own the clothes on our backs, since we got him at the man's store, and hadn't really paid for him according to him. After Uncle James died and Aunt Etha moved away, I didn't have no close family but my sister, Hersha Lee. And after her husband died, she didn't have no cropping deal with her man, and I didn't have one with my man. He put me up in that little shack, gave me one hog a year, not two no more. And I worked 300 acres for him. Never weighed in no cotton. Never got no paycheck. Ever once in a while, the man slipped me a few dollars, maybe 5 or 6 times in all them years. It got to be the 1960s. All them years I worked for them plantations, the man didn't tell me there was colored schools I could have gone to or that I could have learned a trade. He didn't tell me I could have joined the army and worked my way up, earned some money of my own and some respect. I didn't know about World War II, the war in Korea, or the one in Vietnam. And I didn't know colored folk had been rising up all around Louisiana for years demanding better treatment. I didn't know I was different. That might be hard for you to believe. Would you go on down to Louisiana right now and take a drive on down the back roads in Red River Parish, and you might be able to see how a colored man that couldn't read and didn't have no radio, no car, no telephone, and not even electricity might fall through a crack in time and get stuck like a clock that done wound down and quit. I've been seeing electric lights burning in the man's house since I was a boy, but I was still living by coal oil lamp in a shotgun shack with no running water. What happened to me was I got real discouraged. Felt like I wasn't good for nobody and wasn't ever going to be able to do no better. I know there was other places. I had heard my brother Thurman was out in California stacking himself some paper money. So one day, I just decided to head out that way. Didn't think about it much. Just walked out to the railroad tracks and waited for the train to come a-rolling. There was another fella hanging around by the tracks, a hobo who'd been riding the rails for a lot of years, and said he showed me which train was going to California. When that one slowed down to roll through town, we both hopped on. I guess I was about 27, 28 years old by then. I never told nobody I was going, so I guess I still owe the man for all them overalls I bought on credit.
Chapter 14. I was 32 years old when I paid $275,000 for a Williamsburg-style house in an upscale section of Fort Worth. That was a pile of money and a lot of house in 1977, especially in Texas. Dark red brick with white columns supporting a gracious balcony and a Mercedes parked out front. My art dealing career had taken off, and we began living the society page life. I was building my business, and Deborah was the supportive wife. Large charities came knocking, and I often donated $5,000 paintings or hefty gift certificates to raise money at silent auctions, hoping to lure wealthy bidders to my gallery. We attended $1,000-a-plate black-tie charity balls, and Deborah and I got our picture in the paper raising champagne glasses under starry lights. But she couldn't quite get her mind around the logic of that kind of philanthropy. We pay $2,000 to get in, and half that goes to pay for the decorator, she said. And the dress I wore cost $2,000. Why don't we just send in a check for $4,000 and stay home? The charity would make more money that way. It's good for business, I said. Really? How much have you made? Well, none yet. During those years, I spent a week of every month in New York, where I eventually developed a strong partnership with a dealer named Michael Altman, who is still my partner today. About four times each year, I traveled to Paris, squeezing first class, five-star jaunts to Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Florence in between. I bought and sold expensive art, met private clients, schmoozed gallery owners and museum buyers, and managed to sneak in skiing, wine tasting, and chateau weekends. We stayed in Fort Worth until 1986, when I thought I'd outgrown it. Then moved to Dallas, where I thought I could make even more money in art. We moved into a perfectly good million-dollar home in the Park Cities that we tore down to make it nicer, painting it a color that complemented the red Jaguar convertible I parked in the driveway. The Park Cities was a wealthy enclave where the local newspaper, Park Cities People, periodically published a list of best-dressed ladies, most of whom spent at least $200,000 a year on clothes. I didn't mind that, and would probably have been proud to appear on such a list. Deborah was, of course, appalled. We put our children in public school. Reagan spent her early years religious, pledging never to listen to rock music. Back then, she was a sharp dresser like her mom, but as a teenager, she shunned anything that smacked of wealth. At 16, she preferred clothes from the Salvation Army resale to anything from a mall and yearned to be a freedom fighter in South Africa. Carson grew up a kid with a big heart, one always tuned toward God. We loved his little boy's sayings, like the one he used to describe feeling extra tired. "Mommy," he'd say, "I ran out of strong." In high school, he was an all-state wrestler at 103 pounds. In fact, he was a model child, except for the time when, after a little taste of liquor in his senior year, he nearly destroyed his room with his best camper paddle from Connacook Camp, where all good Christian boys go. In Dallas, I threw myself into my work, traveling more, striving for more international market share. I changed cars like I changed Armani suits, and tired of each new toy I acquired as quickly as a toddler on Christmas morning. Deborah, meanwhile, plugged into God. While I pursued the material, she plunged into the spiritual. While I dedicated my life to making money and spent a few minutes parked in a church pew on Sundays, she spent hours at Brian's House, a ministry to homeless babies with AIDS. When I stormed Europe, impressing billionaires with my art savvy, she stormed heaven, praying for the needy. My passion was recognition and success. Her passion was to know God. And so we pursued our separate loves. It didn't take long before our separate loves did not include each other. Billy Graham has managed to maintain his integrity for decades by following a set of hard and fast rules designed to keep married men from doing something stupid. One of Billy's rules is, never allow yourself to be alone with a woman who is not your wife. I should have listened to Billy. In 1988, while on a business trip, I found myself sitting in the Hard Rock Cafe in Beverly Hills, across from the kind of woman who seems to grow indigenously in California, right alongside the palm trees. Willowy, blonde, blue-eyed, a painter, and much younger than I. If the subject had come up over lunch, I probably would have pinned my reason for being there on a loveless marriage. Deborah and I had faked it pretty well for about 5 years, the affluent Christian couple still so in love. Deborah, I learned later, was sure I loved art and money, but not sure I still loved her. I was sure she loved God and our children, and fairly certain she could just barely stand the sight of me. But the subject of Deborah or the kids or the fact that I was married, filing jointly, never came up over lunch. Instead, there was chilled wine, white, and too much of it, a meaningful pause, in the eyes the sparkle of invitation, dancing toward the edge of the cliff and sizing up the distance to the bottom. I would have liked to have thought I swept this woman into a hotel room with my wit and rugged good looks, The truth was, she was more interested in what I could do for her art career. It is a sorry fact of my history that if it hadn't been her, it would have been someone in Paris or Milan or New York City. Anyone who gave me a second look, because I was looking, too, for a way out. I remember for 3 or 4 years secretly wishing Deborah would divorce me, because I didn't have the guts to divorce her and corrupt the Mr. Wonderful image so many of our friends had layered over me like a holiday window cling. In the end, I saw the artist only twice, once in California and once in New York, then confessed to Deborah with a little help from my friends. I confided my conquest to a friend who confided my confidence to his wife, who encouraged me to tell Deborah. If I didn't, she said, she would. Calculating that it was better to rat myself out than look like a weasel, I called the artist from the office one day and told her I couldn't see her anymore. Then I went home and confessed to Deborah. My spin, her disinterest, had driven me into the arms of another woman who wanted me just the way I was, money and all. "What?" she screamed, flying into a rage. 19 years? 19 years? What were you thinking? How could you do this? Shoes, vases, and figurines flew through the air, some a direct hit. When nothing else presented itself as a weapon, Deborah pounded me with her bare fist until her arms wore out and hung limp at her sides. The night spun by in a whirl of sleepless anger. The next morning, we phoned our pastor, then drove to his office where we spent most of the day airing our garbage. In the end, we discovered that neither of us was quite ready to give up. We did still love each other, though in that vestigial way of couples who've worn each other out. We agreed to try to work things out. Back at the house that night, we were sitting in our bedroom retreat, talking when Deborah asked me something that nearly made me faint. "I want to talk to her. Will you give me her phone number?" Deborah's resolve at that moment was like a student skydiver who, once at altitude, strides straight to the plane's open door and leaps without pausing to bat down the butterflies. She picked up the bedroom phone and punched each number as I recited it. "This is Deborah Hall, Ron's wife," she said calmly into the phone. I tried to imagine the shocked face on the other end of the line. "I want you to know that I don't blame you for the affair with my husband," Deborah went on. "I know that I've not been the kind of wife Ron needed, and I take responsibility for that." She paused, listening. "Then, I want you to know that I forgive you," Deborah said. "I hope you find someone who will not only truly love you, but honor you." Her grace stunned me, but not nearly so much as what she said next. "I intend to work on being the best wife Ron could ever want, and if I do my job right, you will not be hearing from my husband again." Deborah quietly placed the phone in its cradle, sighed with relief, and locked her eyes on mine. "You and I are now going to rewrite the future history of our marriage." She wanted to spend a couple of months in counseling, she said, so we could figure out what was broken, how it got that way, and how to fix it. "If you'll do that," she said, "I'll forgive you, and I promise I will never bring this up ever again." It was a gracious offer, considering that I, and not Deborah, had been the traitor. Faster than you can say divorce court, I said, yes.
Chapter 15. First time the train stopped, we was in Dallas. I'd never been outside of Red River Parish. Now here I was in a whole other state. The city was big and close, intimidating. Then the railroad police started messing with us. So me and that hobo fella hopped another boxcar out of there and rode the rails for a while. He showed me the ropes. After a while, I decided to see how I'd make out in Fort Worth. Stayed there a couple of years. Then finally made it out to Los Angeles and stayed there another couple of years. Met a woman. Stayed with her for a while. Me and the law didn't get along too well out there, though. Seemed like I was always in trouble for something or other. So I went on back to Fort Worth. I tried to find work here and there, odd jobs, that kind of thing. But I learned pretty quick there wasn't much call for cotton farmers in the city. Only reason I made out was 'cause Fort Worth was what the rail tramps called hobo heaven. Said anybody that was passing through could always get 3 hots and a cot from some different outfits that was trying to help. And there was plenty of real nice Christian folks, too, who was willing to give you something when you ain't even asking. Maybe a cup of coffee or a dollar. Now, if you think the only way homeless folks gets money is by standing on the corner looking pitiful, that ain't true. Me and my partner met another fella that taught us how to turn nothing into something. First thing we was taught was the hamburger drop, a pretty good trick for keeping a little money in our pockets. First thing you had to do was get you a little grub steak, which usually meant scrapping up about a dollar. That don't take long if you go to the part of downtown where the smart people work, the kind that wear a coat and a tie. Some of them gentlemen give you a whole dollar right out the gate if you just make like you're hungry enough. Some of them give it to you quick, too, so you hurry up and get out of their face so they wouldn't have to smell you too long. But other folks seem like they really wanted to help. They look you in the eye and maybe even smile. I felt kind of bad hustling a dollar off a person like that just so I could pull off the hamburger drop. Anyhow, here's how it worked. After I get my dollar for that day, I go on down to the McDonald's and buy me a hamburger, take a couple of bites out of it, and wrap it back up. Then I pick me out one of them big, tall office buildings that got a trash can on the sidewalk out front. When nobody was looking, I'd stick that wrapped-up burger down in the can and wait. Soon as I saw somebody coming, I pretend like I was digging in the trash. Then I come up with that hamburger and commence to eating it. For sure, somebody always gonna stop and say, "Hey, don't eat that." And they gonna give you some money. 'Cause they think you eating out of the garbage can. They feel real sorry for you, but they don't know it's your garbage that you done put in the can in the first place. You can't fool all the same people all the time. So you got to change locations, and you got to be on the lookout for folks you done fooled already, and let them get on down the road before you start hustling some other fella. At the end of the day, me and my partner put our hamburger drop money together and go on to some joint and eat us a decent meal. And if we done real good that day, we might have enough money left over for a half pint of Jim Beam, what we call antifreeze for the homeless. Next time you walking around in Fort Worth and you see some homeless folks, you might notice that some of them filthy, dirty, and some of them ain't. That's 'cause some street people have done figured out ways to stay clean. Just 'cause you homeless don't mean you got to live like a pig. Me and my partner kept on the same clothes all the time, just warm till they wore out. But we figured out how to keep from smelling. That same fella that taught us the hamburger drop also taught us we could get a good bath at the Fort Worth Water Gardens. The Water Gardens is a city park with a big old fountain in it. Looked kind of like a little stadium with walls made like steps or seats. The water flows down the sides of the fountain and makes a great big pool at the bottom, almost like a swimming pool, except it ain't blue or nothing. There's lots of trees all around it, and back then, the working folks would take their lunch and go down and sit in the shade around the edges and listen to the water rush and sing. There was lots of tourists, too, 'cause folks from out of town just loved to sit and watch that water dance down the walls. Me and my partner learned how to act like tourists. We'd wait till afternoon when there wasn't many folk around, and we'd walk up to the water gardens with our shirts unbuttoned halfway and some soap and a towel in our pockets. Then, when the coast was mostly clear, one of us would act like the other one was pushing him in the water. Then the one in the water pulled the other one in, laughing and joking like we was just friends, horsing around on vacation. We weren't supposed to be in that water, and we sure weren't supposed to take our clothes off. So we soaped up under the water where nobody could see, soaping our clothes and our socks just like you would your body. When we get through washing up and rinsing off, we climb up on a high wall that was part of the park and sleep till the sun baked us dry. We laughed and laughed while we was in that water, but it wasn't no fun. We was like animals living in the woods, just trying to survive. Over the years, I got a few jobs through something called the labor force. You ever go down to the city and seen a bunch of raggedy-looking men crowded on the sidewalk in the early morning? Then you might see a place like the labor force. I was one of them men, showing up in the morning, hoping to get a job doing work nobody else want to do, like picking up trash, cleaning out an old warehouse, sweeping up horse manure after a stock show. I remember one time, they took us way on over to Dallas to clean out the Cowboys stadium. They even let me look at the game for a while. I wanted to work a regular job, but I couldn't read and couldn't write. I didn't look right neither, 'cause I only had one set of clothes that was worn out all the time. And even if somebody was to look past all that, I didn't have no paperwork, like a social security card or a birth certificate. At the labor force, you didn't even have to tell them your name. Somebody just pull around in the truck and holler out something like, "We need 10 men. Construction site needs cleaning." And the first 10 fellas to climb on the truck got the job. At the end of the day, we get $25 cash money, minus the $3 the labor force done advanced you for your lunch. Then they charge you $2 for driving you to your job. So at the end of the day, you get maybe $20, not even enough to rent a room. Now let me ask you something. What you gonna do with $20? Except buy yourself something to eat and maybe a six-pack or something to help you forget you're going to sleep in a cardboard box again that night. Sometimes it's drinking or drugging that lands a man on the streets. And if he ain't drinking or drugging already, most fellas like me start in once we get there. It ain't to have fun. It's to have less misery. To try and forget that no matter how many partners in crime we might hook up with on the street, we is still alone.
Chapter 16. I ended my affair with the Beverly Hills painter only to begin a new one. This one with my wife. With counseling behind us, each of us moved several giant steps in the other's direction. I kept both hands in the art business, but traveled less and spent more time with Deborah, Carson, and Reagan. I also began to take spiritual matters more seriously. Deborah, meanwhile, continued her volunteer work in her pursuit of God, but committed time to the things that interested me. Chief among those became Rocky Top, the 350-acre ranch we bought in 1990. Perched on a 300-foot mesa overlooking a shimmering arc of the Brazos River, the ranch house became a refuge for our family. We decorated it cowboy style, from the buffalo head over the stone fireplace to the autographed his and her boots from Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, to the herd-sized trestle table we parked in the kitchen, big enough to seat 15 hungry hands. So authentic and picturesque were the architecture and decor that Style magazines photographed the house for feature stories. Movie directors paid to use it as a set, and Neiman Marcus began shooting its Christmas catalogs there. But for Deborah, the kids, and me, Rocky Top was a place to escape the clamor of the city. Bald eagles soared and dived above the Brazos, their high keen startling the deer that frequented the river's edge. In a verdant pasture below the house, we kept 28 longhorn cattle. Every year, Deborah gave their babies terribly uncowboyish names like Sophie and Sissy, and I led her. And during the spring, lush thickets of bluebonnets covered the rolling chaparral like a violet quilt. Carson and Reagan were teenagers when we settled in at Rocky Top, and they spent their last few years before college importing carloads of friends, hunting, fishing, and exploring miles of winding trails on horseback. At the ranch, Deborah and I cemented our relationship as best friends and ardent lovers, growing so close that we began to joke that we felt Velcroed at the hearts. The ranch also became our geographical anchor, a place that, wherever else we might move, we knew we would always call home. As it turned out, we did move. In 1998, tired of the Park Cities, the Dallas rat race, and what Deborah would later describe as 12 years of exile in the Far East, we returned to Fort Worth. We moved into a French mansard-roofed rental home on a golf course and began building our new home on a secluded lot near a nature preserve on the Trinity River. Then we began to plan what we thought would be the last half of our lives. We hadn't been in Fort Worth for more than a few days when Deborah spied an item in the Star-Telegram about homelessness in the city. The piece mentioned a place called the Union Gospel Mission. At the time, an insistent voice in Deborah's heart told her it was a place she might fit. Not long afterward, a letter arrived from Debbie Brown, an old friend, inviting us to join Friends of the Union Gospel Mission, a circle of philanthropic donors. Deborah immediately told me that not only did she want to join, she also intended to inquire about volunteering at the mission itself. "I was hoping you'd go with me," she said, smiling and tilting her head in a way so irresistible, I sometimes thought she should register it for a patent. The mission on East Lancaster Street was tucked deep in a nasty part of town. While it was true that the murder rate in Texas had been falling, I was sure that anyone still doing any murdering probably lived right around there. I smiled back. "Sure, I'll go." But secretly, I hoped that once she actually rubbed shoulders with the kind of scuzzy derelicts that had robbed my gallery, Deborah would find it too scary, too real, to volunteer on East Lancaster. Then we could revert to doing our part by dropping off some old clothes or furniture, or if she really found it tough to tear herself away, more money. I should have known better. For other than yellow jackets, and black diamond ski slopes, Deborah feared only one thing.
Chapter 17. Now, believe it or not, there used to be what you might call a code of honor, or unity, in the hobo jungle. Down there, if one fella got himself a can of Vienna sausages, and there was five other fellas around, then he gonna give each one of them a sausage. The same goes for his six-pack and his half-pint and his dope. 'Cause who knows whether somebody else might have something he want a piece of the very next day. One of the fellas in my circle had him a car he was living in, a gold Ford Galaxy 500. Me and him got to be pretty tight. So one time, when he was running from the law and he had to get out of town for a spell, he asked me to watch out for his car. It sure wasn't no new car, but I liked it, and it run pretty good. I didn't drive it around much, 'cause I never had drove nothing but a tractor. But he'd been staying in it, so I figured I would too. That's when I got me an idea. There was enough room in there for more than just one fella to sleep. So I started renting out two sleeping spots in the back seat, $3 a night. Fellas said it'd beat sleeping on the sidewalk. I had me a regular Galaxy Hilton there for a while, till the police showed up and hauled it off, and said my little hotel had unpaid tickets and no insurance. Regular folks that live in neighborhoods and go to work every day don't know nothing about no life like that. If you took a normal fella and dropped him off in the hobo jungle or under the bridge, he wouldn't know what to do. You got to be taught to live homeless. You ain't gonna put on no suit and no tie and think you're gonna be pulling off the hamburger drop. So I had me some partners for a while. But after a few winters went by, I began to pull away from the folks I've been running with. Kind of slipped off into silence. I don't know why. Some kind of mental adjustment, maybe. Or maybe I was just going a little bit crazy. For a real long time, I didn't speak to nobody and didn't want nobody speaking to me. Got to where if I felt threatened, I'd attack. I took some money from a hamburger drop and bought me a .22 pistol. Thought I might need it for protection. You get a spirit in you. A spirit makes you feel like nobody in the world cares nothing about you. Don't matter if you live or die. People with that spirit get mean, dangerous. They play by the rules of the jungle. I earn respect with my fists. One time, I was talking on a public telephone, and this fella that was waiting to use it come up and hung up the phone while I was still talking. I took that telephone and broke it on his head. He fell on the ground, hollering and holding his head, blood gushing out between his fingers. I just walked away. Another time, while I was sleeping under the tracks, some gangsters from the projects crept up in the hobo jungle and started stealing what little bit the homeless folks had. They was young black fellas, acting the way some young fellas act, like can't nothing touch 'em long as they stick together and cuss you loud enough. It was dark, and I was lying inside my cardboard box awake when I heard 'em slither up whispering. Now, I can't use the kind of language I used that night, so let me just say I called them some names. I busted out that box with a sawed-off piece of steel pipe in my hand and started swinging. You done tried to jack the wrong man. I'll kill you. You think I won't? I'll kill you. There was three of them. But when a crazy-looking homeless man is swinging a pipe at every head in sight and threatening murder, three against one ain't no good gamble. They took off running, and so did I. Straight to the Gold Ford Galaxy that my friend had then got back from the police. I jumped in and dug the key out of the seat cushion where I knowed he'd stashed it. Then I cranked up the Galaxy and headed for the projects to get me some revenge. I couldn't see the thieves no more, but I know where they come from, and the projects was just a few blocks away. I was driving fast, and pretty soon I could see the brick buildings peeking up over the long, low dirt pile somebody put up along the streets to keep cars from driving up where the folks stayed. When I got to that dirt pile, I never even slowed down. Just jumped the curb and punched the gas. That Galaxy zoomed up that dirt hill and went airborne, just like you see them daredevils do on TV. I landed smack in the middle of the projects with the car smoking like a coal train. I jumped out with the engine still running and started hollering, "Bring it on, bring it on. Come out, I'll kill you." It was late, but there were still a few people in a big courtyard. Most of them ran in their houses, the mamas snatching up their children and hustling them indoors. Didn't take long before lights started coming on. I knowed folks was calling the police on me, so I jumped back in the car and sped out of there. I had created a real problem and had to go hide out for a spell. The police come and took my friend's Galaxy again, but they didn't arrest him because he swore somebody stole it. I guess I had, since I didn't tell him I was taking it. Besides, he didn't match the eyewitness stories of the man's folks said had crashed a flying gold car into the middle of the projects. If all that had happened these days, somebody probably would have pulled out a gun and tried to shoot me dead. But back then, not a single one of them boys would come out and face me. I guess they thought a man crazy enough to jump a car into a place with women and children around might be crazy enough to kill him. They was right. If I had found him, I would have, especially if I thought to grab my gun. I had to lay low for a while after that, so I hightailed it back to Louisiana to let the heat die down. Took my pistol with me. That's how I wound up in one of the worst hell holes ever invented by a white man. I made it to Shreveport, but I didn't have no money. I had that .22, though, and I figured if I waved it around at somebody who did have some money, they might give me some of it. I ain't proud of this one bit now, but I decided to rob a city bus. All I had to do was wait on a corner till a bus slowed down and stopped. When the door opened, I jumped up on the steps and showed the driver my pistol. "Open the box and give me that money," I hollered. There was just a couple of folks on the bus, and they ducked down in their seats real quick. One lady started crying. The driver's eyes got real big. "I can't open it," he said, his voice kind of shaking a little. "I don't have a key." "You can't get the money out unless you break it." I looked down at the money in the box and then at the folks hunkering down in the bus. I could hear that lady still crying. I looked back at the driver and saw he was looking at my gun. Then I got off the bus. I was mean and bad, but not mean and bad enough to shoot a man just because he showed up for work on the wrong day. But now I had the law on my tail in Fort Worth and Shreveport, so I decided to turn myself in. I didn't tell the police my real name, though. Told them my name was Thomas Moore. But it wouldn't have mattered to the judge if my name was Abraham Lincoln. He found me guilty of armed robbery and sent me to Angola Prison for 20 years. It was May 1968. Now, in case you ain't heard nothing about Angola, it was hell, surrounded on three sides by a river. I didn't know this then, but in those days, it was the darkest, most vicious prison in America. A few days after I got there, a prisoner I had met back at Shreveport Jail saw me and reached out like he was going to shake my hand. Instead, he gave me a knife. "Put this under your pillow," he said. "You going to need it." I was back in the fields again. Except this time, I really was a slave. Because that's how they ran the prison, like a plantation. Except it was prisoners working crops all day in the sweltering sun. And there wasn't enough guards. So they turned some of the inmates into guards. Even gave them guns. They like to point them at us while we work. A lot of times, the same fellas that was working with me one day didn't come back the day after that. And nobody ever saw them again. In those days, a man in Angola without a knife was either going to wind up raped or dead. For the first few years I was there, at least 40 men got stabbed to death, and another bunch, hundreds of them, got cut up bad. I did what I had to do to protect myself. I was on what you call two-for-one time. Judge locked me up for 20 years, but they let me out after 10. I was ashamed to go do something like try and live off of Herschel Lee. So I went on back to Fort Worth. I knowed I wasn't going to have no home or no job there, but I knowed how to get by. Word got around on the streets that I'd been in Angola and wasn't nobody to be messing with. I didn't scare everybody, though. I slept in the doorway of that United Way over on Commerce Street for a whole lot of years. And every morning for all of that time, a lady who worked there brought me a sandwich. I never knowed her name, and she never knowed mine. I wish I could thank her. Funny, though, that United Way building was right next door to a church. And for all them years, nobody at that church ever looked my way. I've been sleeping there for a long time when the Fort Worth police put up no lottering signs all over the place and made me have to move my sleeping spot. I found out later some rich white folks was revitalizing downtown. Raggedy black fellas sleeping on the sidewalks wasn't part of the plan. The police told me I needed to be going down to the Union Gospel Mission after sleeping on the streets. I don't know, maybe 15-20 years. I wasn't fixing to move indoors just like that. So I put my blanket on the concrete next to an old empty building across from the mission. Mr. Schisler, the manager of the mission, told me over and over I didn't need to be sleeping outside in the weather. After some years went by, I let him give me a bed. He let me clean up around the mission for my keep.
Chapter 18. When Deborah was 6 years old, she started a fire club. To get in, her friends had to steal some matches from their mama's kitchens and hand them over to Deborah so she could show them how they worked. During one such lesson, she almost burned down an oil field camp in Premont, where she lived, a near disaster resulting in a leather belt spanking from her daddy that kept her out of a bathing suit for weeks. Another time, just to see what would happen, she collected a bucket full of bullfrogs and dumped them into the laps of three ladies who were playing bridge with her mama. What happened was shrieking ladies, upended iced tea, and another spanking. So here we were, in our 50s, with me hoping some bums in littered alleyways would scare her when the only things on earth she really feared were black ice, yellow jackets, and rattlesnakes. Not exactly your shrinking violet. She did have one other fear, though, missing the call of God. And she felt called to work at the mission. I wish I could say I felt God had tapped me for the assignment, too, but I didn't. But I did feel called to be a good husband, so I went. The Union Gospel Mission sits just beyond the beauty of the restored section of Fort Worth, a city that became a national model for downtown revitalization, thanks to the billionaires who loved it. In that part of town, soaring glass towers pulse with legal intrigue and high finance. Nearby, warmer-looking buildings, refaced with brick and brownstone, lined sidewalks graced with raised iron flower boxes, manicured trees, and, after all, it's Texas, topiaries of longhorn cattle. A cultural district spans three city blocks, housing three world-class museums, the Kimball, the Amon Carter, and the Modern. A mile east, cafes open onto cobblestone plazas where dazzling urbanites can sip lattes and mineral water and watch cowboys amble by in their boots and spurs. Travel farther east, though, and the colors and flora of restoration fade into hopelessness and despair. Drive under the I-30, I-35 interchange, pass beneath an impossible pretzel of freeways called the Mixmaster, and through a tunnel that efficiently separates the haves from the unsightly have-nots, and there are no more plazas or monuments or flower boxes, and certainly no more dazzling urbanites. In their place, tumble-down buildings with busted-out glass, walls scarred with urine stains and graffiti, gutters choked with beer cans and yellowed newspapers, and vacant lots blanketed in Johnson grass, tall enough to conceal a sea of empty vodka bottles and assorted drunks. Driving out of that tunnel shocks most people into realizing they made a wrong turn. But on a sun-splashed Monday in the early spring of 1998, Deborah and I drove out there on purpose. She propelled by her passion to help the broken, and I propelled by a love for my wife. As we passed out of the dark tunnel onto East Lancaster Street, we witnessed a curious one-way migration, a streaming of people, like tributaries all flowing east into a single larger river of souls. On our left, a string of shabby men staggered from the Johnson grass that covered a lot. To the right, a parade of women and children in dirty, mismatched clothes shambled along, dragging green garbage bags. One boy, about 8, wore only a man's undershirt and black socks. "They're going to the mission," Deborah said, beaming as if the entire ragtag bunch was long-lost TCU alumni and she just couldn't wait to catch up. I managed some sort of agreeing noise and a thin smile. To me, they looked as if they'd somehow found a portal from the Middle Ages and squeaked through just in time to escape the plague. When we reached the mission, I bumped our truck over the driveway dip where a brown-trousered fat man dangled a cigarette from his lips and stood guard at a rusted chain-link gate. I offered my friendliest East Texas grin. "We're here to volunteer," I told him. He flashed back a toothless smile, and I swear his cigarette never moved, just clung to his bottom lip as though he'd tacked it there with a stapler. I had pulled into the parking lot, wondering how quickly I'd be able to pull out again, but Deborah suddenly spoke in a tone that you learn to recognize when you've loved someone for years, a tone that says, "Hear me on this." "Ron, before we go in, I want to tell you something." She leaned back against her headrest, closed her eyes. I picture this place differently than it is now. White flower boxes lining the streets, trees and yellow flowers, lots of yellow flowers, like the pastures at Rocky Top in June. Deborah opened her eyes and turned to me with an expectant smile. Can't you just see that? No vagrants, no trash in the gutters, just a beautiful place where these people can know God loves them as much as he loves the people on the other side of that tunnel. I smiled, kissed my fingertips, and laid them against her cheek. Yes, I can see that. And I could. I just didn't mention that I thought she was getting a little ahead of herself. She hesitated, then spoke again. I had a dream about it. About this place? Yes, she said, gazing at me intently. I saw this place changed. It was beautiful. Like I was saying, with the flowers and everything, it was crystal clear, like I was standing right here, and it was the future already. Inside the mission, we met the director, Don Schisler. In his early 50s and stocky, with a short beard and close-cropped hair, he looked more like a banker or an accountant than a caretaker of the homeless, though I'm not sure what I thought one of those was supposed to look like. Don introduced us to Pam, the volunteer coordinator, who led us on a tour of the common areas, including the kitchen and the chapel. Both were dirty and windowless and reeked of body odor, old grease, and other not quite identifiable odors that made me want to turn and flee. In the kitchen, we slid like roller skaters along the greasy floor, straight into the sweltering office of a chain-smoking live wire named Chef Jim. Jim Morgan was the kind of fellow who, like any self-respecting Baptist, passes up handshakes and goes straight to hugs. He first wrapped me in a back-slapping embrace like an old college pal, then gave Deborah a kinder, gentler squeeze. Thin and graying, he looked 65, but might have been younger. He wore checked pants and a chef's tunic, surprisingly unstained. Chef Jim gabbed with us enthusiastically about God, homeless folks, and, to a lesser degree, food. Extremely articulate. He used words I'd never heard before, and he didn't fit my notion of a homeless person, which at the time was someone who was probably uneducated or at least not very smart for having gotten themselves in such a fix in the first place. As it turned out, Chef Jim was a fellow TCU alumnus whose teenage son had died tragically, an event that landed his wife in a mental institution. Jim, by contrast, numbed his double dose of grief with rivers of liquor and drugs, which cost him his job as head of catering at an international hotel chain, then his home. Now he was at the mission, plying his trade for room and board while attempting to rebuild his life. Jim shared his story with self-deprecating humor without an ounce of blame or self-pity. Then he encouraged us to come on down and dish up supper for the homeless once a week. Infect them with love, he said. He couldn't have used a more appropriate word, since infection was probably my greatest fear. Spending hours each week captive in a kitchen that smelled like rotten eggs boiled in pine sol was bad enough. I fervently did not want to be touched for fear of the germs and parasites I suspected floated in every particle of the air.